UPN Friday on Star Trek Enterprise, the unbelievable.
Those are P-51s.
Captain Archer is dead.
In a battle to destroy history, the future will never be the same.
Germany has launched a successful invasion of the United States.
Why are you changing history? You're helping the Germans win the war. Why?
The world will be yours, and the future will belong to us all.
Star Trek Enterprise.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast for two Trek fans. Step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the front,
this is Tyler Orton, walking around Nazi-occupied New York City in a zoot suit, bragging about my life as a loan shark and hoping that the Nazis don't notice me.
Not again.
Happens all the time.
And we're here this time to talk about the Enterprise Season 4 opening two-parter, Stormfront.
Yeah, this is really, I guess, kind of the do-over efforts that I think Manny Coto coming in as showrunner this season after being a big writer on season 3 of Enterprise. He's trying to right the ship after the convoluted temporal Cold War shenanigans here, Cam.
Yeah, yeah. And I gotta say, we talked last time when we talked about Shockwave and asked, you know, why has the title Shockwave not been used a few times? It seems like such an awesome name. Stormfront's pretty good, too.
Not bad, not bad. Yeah. I guess the question that we want to tackle here, though, is how well does Stormfront right the ship after just having to follow this very confusing temporal Cold War? You never knew what anyone's motives were. You never knew really what the characters were planning, these temporal agents, so to speak. And I think that's what we really want to dig into with Stormfront.
There's a lot to actually dig into with this one, more than you would think.
Yeah. So my own memory, though, is I heard how the season finale of season 3 ended, and everybody on the Trek PBS was mocking space Nazis.
Right.
And so I remember just watching the first 5-10 minutes, maybe up to the teaser for the premiere, just to see whether I thought Enterprise was going on the right track. Because the thing is, Manny Coto was actually giving like good interviews over the summer. I do remember reading some of the things that he was saying. He was talking a lot about like the stories that he would have wanted to see as a Star Trek fan.
Well, and as a Star Trek fan, I would imagine he gave a hell of an interview too. Like, I'm sure he would say all the things that fans would be salivating over.
So I was intrigued, but then I just, I don't know, I wasn't convinced that this was going to be the way to really kick it off.
Boy, were you wrong.
I know. Here. And the thing is, we have been talking about maybe whether we'd ever do like a space Nazi episode for the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of realized like it's a very sensitive subject, and the way that we usually tackle these sorts of subjects is we'd be goofing around.
Sure.
And pure coincidence, though, you and I, we just saw the movie Jojo Rabbit with Taika Waititi, wrote and directed that one.
Mm-hmm.
And it has come under criticism for making maybe Nazis seem a little bit lovable.
Sure.
Which I can understand that criticism there. But overall, I will commend Enterprise for not trying to make the Nazis lovable. I think there are some very interesting things that they're doing here.
And there's some like racially really awful dialogue, too, that I was actually shocked to hear. Because initially, in the revisit of this one, I'm thinking like, you know, it feels a little weird to be doing such a, you know, kind of light, goofy Star Trek story like this now. You know, in Patterns of Force in the original series, different time, different era. But I was actually shocked when I heard some dialogue like that, and I said, oh, they actually aren't backing away from the implications of World War II in this two-parter. And I was at least, you know, we'll get into the greater picture of this two-parter, but at least in that aspect, I could commend the writers for at least not just saying, hey, we're just using this as, you know, wallpaper for a wacky, you know, historical time travel story.
Did you have any idea that space Nazis were coming up as you were doing your watch of Star Trek Enterprise, Cam, initially?
I would say there was a 0% chance that that occurred to me.
So what was your reaction when you were watching Zero Hour?
I think I was annoyed. And it has less to do with the idea of setting up this two-parter. It was more like how it completely, I felt like, sucked the energy out of the conclusion to a spectacular finale of Zero Hour. finishing off the Zindi arc. Like, I was so on board for that arc, especially those last few episodes are so strong. And then the big finale hits and I'm just, you know, I'm jumping on the couch with excitement throughout. And then it cut to this and it just completely was like cut the legs out from it.
Well, it's a complete non sequitur. Yes. Like, it really doesn't have anything to do with what we were watching before. They I guess Manny Coto tries to tie it in by saying that, you know, there's kind of the temporal Cold War connection, which we got with the Zindi arc. I think he was just really trying to fix something where Brandon Braga was just like, let's leave him with a cliffhanger they won't forget. And I don't think he ever really thought beyond that, though.
Well, you hear the story, you know, of Best of Both Worlds Part 1, where when they wrote that finale, they were kind of like, well, Michael Piller was like, someone else can figure that out for season 4.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he ended up having to do it. But you get the sense that that's what happened here, where, you know, at the end of Zero Hour, Braga and whatever, and Berman were just like, someone else can figure this out. It's not. It doesn't feel organic. As you said, it was a non sequitur at the end of season 3. So it's just frustrating.
Just a slight side note, I should say that we are recording this on Remembrance Day. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of an interesting thing for us to be watching Space Nazis on Remembrance Day.
That occurred to me as I was watching it. I was like, what a weird connection.
Yeah.
And we did not plan this.
It's interesting because so I was at the gym this morning and the PA system came up at about 11 a.m. and asked for a moment of silence, which almost everybody in the gym abided by, except for one guy who wouldn't stop talking and people weren't responding to him. They were all in silence and it was just kind of awkward. It took him, I think, a good solid 22 seconds to shut up. Mm-hmm. So there you go. That out of the way. Why don't we just dive right into this one?
Sure.
You know, it opens up with, of course, you know, Trip and Mayweather trying to outflank these P-51s.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of... I think what Manny Coto wanted was for us to kind of be gripped by the action.
Yeah.
This does not look like a cheap opener for the season premiere. Like, I think they put a lot of money into this. When you look at the location shoots, you look at the VFX that were done here. I think they did want to try to fix some of the weirdness that was going on with the cliffhanger the season or the summer before.
Well, it's definitely going for eye-grabbing visuals. And I mean, I didn't think the ones off the top work, but there were some in this two-parter that did grab me and I thought were incredibly effective. So I like the idea. I like seeing the Enterprise, you know, being attacked by World War II ships. Like, that's just kind of a fun idea.
Or the Shuttlepod 1.
Sorry, Shuttlepod 1. Yeah.
But just speaking of imagery, though, look, the White House has Nazi banners hanging from it. There are panzers on the front lawn.
That is a great image.
Yeah.
Like when you see that, that is a definitely high impact image to see on the episode.
And I'm such a geek. Like, I'm looking at the Nazi map that they have going on in that, I guess, the Oval Office or whatever it was there. And I was like, huh. Not interested in the rest of North America, huh? Nazis is just like, I kind of wish there was a little bit more world building. Like, I don't know exactly what Winston Churchill was up to. Like, obviously they had said that the United Kingdom had fallen. But there's kind of other interesting things to pick apart. How, you know, like, there's supposedly temporal agents that had assassinated Lenin. Mm-hmm. And so,
1916.
Russian Empire persisted. There was no Bolshevik Revolution or anything like that. And so the Nazis concentrated on the Western Front. Just those kinds of things. Like, it's exposition dump, but I kind of like that world building that goes on in an episode like this.
Does it annoy you a little bit, though, the idea of they set up all of this really kind of fun alternate history stuff, but they are like, don't worry, if we fix this one thing, it'll just hand wave everything perfect again.
Yeah, and that's ultimately why I came down on Year of Hell as a two-parter for Voyager. Like, that just kind of bugged me, where it's just like, just hit the giant reset button. Mm-hmm. But what do you think about, like, the idea of resetting three seasons of ongoing storylines? Not that our characters never experienced that, but... all that needed to be done to fix all of these ginormous problems that had been created was just destroy Nazi alien compounds.
I mean, I don't know that I would say it fixes the problem. I would say it just erases the problem so that they don't have to deal with it anymore. And I think that's kind of the problem. Like, this all feels incredibly simplistic.
But I think it's kind of the best thing that they could have done in this situation.
You look at what came in season 4. Yeah, it was good to get it completely off the board and move on to other stuff.
Were there any temporal Cold War fans out there?
Like, I doubt it.
I don't think so. Like, I don't think anybody cared.
But I was, like, cracking up watching this. And, you know, you have Daniels come back and he's like, oh, you know, the temporal Cold War has become a full-blown conflict. I'm like, Has it? I guess. Whatever.
Well, I laughed at that because don't conflicts become wars? He's like, the wars become a conflict.
Yeah.
I was like, well, okay. That's the way to put it. Mind you, I think Daniel's really got the Harry Kim Species 8472 treatments in this episode. I kind of felt bad for the actor until the very end of it, where he got to look like his regular Trent Reznor loving self in that a cosplay that he had on there.
Right. Singing Head Like a Hole.
Yeah. Best cut scene that we never got to see on the special features, but that was just a very weird, like, don't you feel bad where like the actor's nostrils are all splayed out and it's just kind of like, okay, gotta cash those checks whatever way you can, sir.
And the makeup was pretty outlandish on him to the point where I felt like they really had to establish through characters that this is Daniels, guys.
I didn't think they needed to have Matt Winston play Daniels through like the first 90% of this two-parter, like not until the very end. It's like they could have gotten away with like his body double.
Kind of like the James Cromwell in which TNG two-parter was it where he was recast or he was injured for the second part?
That was, Worf, Birthright.
Birthright, okay.
Where Worf is throwing spears through hoops.
Yeah. Yeah, right, like, right.
That's the most hilarious recast ever, though. You know, James Cromwell.
Where it's like the body double in part two who's not saying anything, but is like waving in the distance, like, come over here, guys.
Well, for those that might not remember, like, James Cromwell, I think he, broke his arm or something, or broke his leg during
the
shooting of that. So they just kind of erased the character and had like this alien, like a very, very like big alien like makeup job on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Lucky for them, I suppose. So,
but that did remind me of Daniels here, where it's just like, wow.
Yeah. But let's get into some of the other interesting stuff, though. We kind of alluded to it, but kind of tackling Nazis in New York City, where United States, especially New York City itself, diverse country.
Mm-hmm.
So what do the Nazis want to do with a diverse country that it's not nearly as monolithic as, say, you know, Poland or France or whatever like that, where it's easy for them to point to, you know, the Jewish population, point to the Roma population or the homosexual population.
Right.
What if it's just that much more a significant part of society and stuff? And there's some very horrifying things that the Nazis say to Alicia Travers, who is kind of our avatar into this world throughout this, a woman of color whose husband is out fighting in the Pacific Theater and all that. And you know, like, I don't necessarily think we need to repeat some of the things, but I'm like, I'm glad that, you know, back, you know, 15 years ago, that they're ready to push forward and say, hey, guys, like, the Nazis, it's fun to have these adventures, but let's not forget, like, how horrific it was.
Yeah.
Like, what they're trying to do with, like, this Aryan master race.
It really did shock me to hear that dialogue, not coming out of Nazis, but coming out of them in Star Trek, because, you know, early in the episode, you have that scene where Archer's in, like, the back of a truck with, you know, a Nazi who's, like, spouting off about, you know, Betty Grable and Veronica Lake and stuff like that, and that felt more of that poppy, goofy World War II movie kind of stuff.
Almost Inglourious Basterds, you know, like, should I order drinks with three fingers on one side of the hand or the other side of the hand?
Yeah, exactly. Although, didn't Tom Paris in The Killing Game start talking about Betty Grable's legs?
Or was that he was quizzing Harry Kim on who's...
That was his code or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, like for like women's body parts.
And it was Betty Grable's legs was like the answer.
Cam,
what is with the Betty Grable references?
We were just like dismayed by that. Like, how many 500-year-old women are you like studying the body parts of now?
I prefer not to answer that.
The only answer that I could give you is Mona Lisa's smile.
Exactly. So that's the only one.
Yeah. It's kind of bizarre, but like you were saying though, it's like those are kind of the, not the whimsical Nazis, but more of the pop culture Nazis.
Exactly.
Scene.
And so that's what I was prepared for off of that opening with Archer.
Yeah. So I think it was interesting that they actually went there. And,
but did they go far enough? Like, I think this could have been more interesting.
They could have pushed it further, but there was other interesting things like Vosk is the antagonist, the alien Nazi, the space Nazi, so to speak, here.
Yeah.
And he was talking how they both believe in pure racial lines and how they actually had a biological weapon that they could have given to the Nazis and saying, like, we could just leave all non-Aryans dead and no more extermination camps for you. Like, that's frightening stuff. And you wonder about, like, the stakes in some of these two-parters that we get here. I find that to be a far more interesting stake to have versus, I don't know, I'll pick on Discovery a little bit, but do you remember at the end of the Mirror Universe arc, we were essentially told the stakes are the end of the universe?
Right.
It's like if they don't complete their mission, the universe, as we know it, is going to be destroyed.
They've done that a couple times on Discovery, Tyler.
But it's just kind of like you don't really buy those stakes because you kind of know that it's going to be a very short season if they don't complete their mission. So you kind of shrug at this. Although I think we can be rest assured that there's no Aryan like disease that wiped out humanity.
Right. Although were they ever really going to give that to the Nazis? It seemed like a lot of it was them just using that to bait the Nazis into assisting them.
But either way, like I don't think that matters. I think what matters is like that offer was on the table. It was something that the audience was said, hey, this could be a possibility. So I just thought that was an interesting thing.
It was, yeah.
You know, did they ever name Vosk's species? Like that's kind of like confused me like throughout
this. No, they didn't.
Yeah, but we also got the return. Another one of Vosk's species was one Tom Wright, a.k.a. Tuvix from, the episode Tuvix.
Yeah.
So we actually had fun with this a couple years ago in Vegas, because remember, like, Marina Sirtis was, like, chiding some fan who said, you know, like, hey, what's it like to work with so-and-so? Mm-hmm. And she's like, that's a dumb question. Like, we're never going to, like, you know, S-talk some sort of actor that we've worked with. We're only going to say, like, nice things. So, like, think of other questions. And then, like, I don't know, an hour later, Kate Mulgrew came out on stage and started just, like, ripping apart Tom Wright, the actor, and saying, like, how impossible he was to work with.
Yeah.
And so
I've also heard Marina Sirtis say some things about Stuart Baird, the director of Nemesis. So maybe it only extends to actors, not so much directors.
Well, you know what? Next convention, let's go ask her about Stuart Baird. Like, I can't wait to hear more. No, I've heard all the actors complain about him. Like, I remember LeVar Burton was very annoyed that Stuart Baird kept referring to him as an alien.
Right.
And he's like, no, I'm human just like you, sir. So.
But, yeah, like, the one thing I had, though, this Voss character, I found him incredibly dull as an adversary. Like, taking away all, like, the ideas this character has and what his plotting is for this unnamed alien species that are apparently major players in the temporal Cold War I've never heard of.
And we've never seen before.
Never seen before, yeah. Never see after.
Well, they're from the 29th century, Cam.
That's true.
So there you go.
But I found Vosk to be just almost charisma-free as a villain.
Yeah, but I guess there's only so much you can do underneath that makeup. It was interesting, though. I thought Tom Wright's character. I wonder if like Tom Wright was up for the Vosk role himself.
It would make sense that he was, right?
I just thought that Tom Wright brought a lot more to his, you know, brief scene that he was there than we got from the actor playing Vosk, though. And I there's just breaking through all that makeup, you know, it can be a challenge, and then maybe some actors are more adept at doing that. But I really like the look of this alien species, though.
It's kind of like a catfish kind of look.
And like, just the red contacts were done to good use, like the veins popping out of their skin. I was just like, you know, like props to the makeup team for making somebody very memorable, and we only got to see them over the course of like three episodes, really.
I had to wonder, though, how much of the impact of the visual of these characters is drained from the Herogen in The Killing Game? Like, we've seen these really cool, you know, effects, makeup effects characters in Nazi regalia before on Star Trek. And when we cut to it here, like, I like the makeup, too. Like, I think it's a really cool job. But is that image that much more powerful if we haven't seen it in a very, very well-known Voyager two-parter?
Yeah, but I think you just got to go with the flow. You know, does that mean because the Herogen already appeared as Nazis, you never do another space Nazi episode again? Guess what? I have no problems with Star Trek never doing a space Nazi episode again.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't hung up on the fact that I'd already seen Herogen. I totally know what you're saying, though, because we had already seen aliens in this Nazi regalia before. But I think they're a distinct enough look, just from, like, skin color to just, like, kind of those the protrusions on their face, like you said, kind of that catfish look.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter to me, though, because, like, I thought it was such a very cool, distinct imagery for this antagonist that we got to follow along here, though. Although, I still go back to Tom Wright, again, wearing a zoot suit as that catfish alien. Like, that's... Cam, props to you for still trying to make zoot suits happen, you know? But
I'm a big fan of the mask.
Yeah. just don't really. Who was the guy who played Damien in that movie? Like, he was like kind of the quintessential late 80s, early 90s, like villain actor, bad boy actor.
That was Peter Green.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
yeah. Shout out to Peter Green.
Just like the mask, same color.
That's right. No, like, I actually found Tom Wright's character more interesting. He kind of had a more interesting film noir kind of vibe. And I'm like thinking as I'm watching it, like, do more with this type of character. Like, I've seen the Nazi villain before. Like, I've seen it done. I think, better in The Killing Game. I'm not a big Killing Game fan, but I felt like the Hirogen character had more impact on me as a viewer, as a character I actually remembered in terms of personality than Vosk. So it's like, give us a different angle. Like, give us this Tom Wright version, which is doing different things. He has a different approach to, you know, he's much more in the shadows. Like, what happens if they have to investigate characters that are more on the sidelines, like working in the shadows? That's more interesting, at least.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I just found a lot of this very flat. Like, I found a lot of the intrigue of, you know, part one we're talking about right now, but like, I found a lot of it just very dry and just not interesting to sit through because it's almost devoid of character.
Save for, I think Archer was getting some interesting things to do there.
He gets a few moments.
Any excuse to take his shirt off and any excuse to have Scott Bakula in the makeup chair.
Mm-hmm.
How many episodes does Scott Bakula have to sit in the makeup chair all day long before he's allowed to go on set? Like, this guy always has like a black eye or a scrape on his face. So once again, he had like a burn on his face in this particular episode.
Yes.
So good on him. And the thing that confused me most is, remember when like Alicia is feeding him dinner?
Yeah.
I was looking at what they're eating.
What was that?
I couldn't figure it out. It looked like a giant green pepper with couscous like filled in it.
Right.
And I was like, why would they be eating that in like 1944 New York City?
Well, and she said the Germans took all of the good stuff. So I would have to assume we're working with pretty bare bones ration type stuff. Like, so we're talking about what? Like potatoes and like cabbage?
Well, they had like carrots and peas on their plate, but then like this weird dish, like it looked like a giant pepper, a stuffed pepper. I was like, what? Like, I found it distracting though. Yeah. So
to wait for the Enterprise cookbook.
As authored by Chef.
Right.
The man we never got to meet, aka Jonathan Frakes.
Does that mean like Jonathan Frakes is on the cover?
He should be.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
Like, okay. He's the closest, you know, I guess visual cue that we have for Chef.
How amazing would it be if we found out Jonathan Frakes had to drop out of directing an episode of Picard next season because he was writing the cookbook, the Enterprise cookbook?
I find it quite unlikely that would ever come to fruition. I don't see that happening.
Don't you like, wouldn't you love to live in that world though, where you see that in the press?
Oh, that'd be hilarious.
Yeah.
It wouldn't make sense, but... Yeah. So we are following the characters along, trying to save their captain. We've got kind of the Reed and she is actually Mayweather and Trip
I liked seeing those two paired up because Mayweather is usually ignored, and it was fun to see him go on the actual mission.
Yeah. And then we've got Silic. He's back in the equation. I think this is the only time that we really give Silic any sort of nuance.
Right.
And of course, it means that they got to kill him immediately after that. But it's kind of, it's explaining what Silic's stakes are and what Silic's motives are.
Mm-hmm.
And we really don't get much of that throughout his run as a three-season antagonist.
You could say that for the entirety of the Suliban species, which have played a huge role. We talked a lot about them in Shockwave, as well as Broken Bow. And you look at how much depth they went into in those two-parters versus this.
It just seemed as if, like, they never really got beyond the concept of them and gave us something really to sink our teeth into in terms of, like, I guess, pathos to a certain degree. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just like they should have given us a reason to, like, understand their viewpoint, where they're coming from, and then we could kind of follow them along. And I'm not saying cheer for them, but, like, at least understand what their motivations were beyond wanting to have genetic enhancements. And it's just kind of like, okay.
Because when all is said and done, and you ask me, you know, were the Suliban like a villainous species? Were they sympathetic? Was there something to them? My answer is like, I don't know. Like, it's very hard for me to answer that question.
Well,
gets so muddy.
The one thing I guess I can look forward to, or maybe we'll find out one of these days, like, we find out eventually from Daniels that the Zindi will join the Federation.
Sure.
Maybe that opportunity is there for the Suliban, you know, maybe in the 25th century.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know, like, I'd be curious about a species trying to integrate itself into the Federation, and they're all about genetic enhancements, which we know is banned by the Federation.
Right.
Just when you look at Earth's history, everything that has to do with Khan, and look, they spent, what, 3 episodes specifically dealing with it on Deep Space Nine with Bashir's enhancements and the other people who did not have such a great you know, experience with those enhancements either. So I think it'd be interesting to kind of pick that thread up. But I really don't know if Patrick Stewart is coming into those meetings at the Paramount lot and he's like, I want the Suliban.
That's the only reason he came back. He's like, guys, I just feel like I didn't get the finality I needed with the Suliban.
Stewart's like, I'm future guy. Make that happen, guys.
His pitch for the series, Patrick Stewart walked into CBS. He's like, the Suliban? Make it so.
I like it. Yeah. Going into, I don't know, final thoughts on part one before we kind of go more to the part two sort of stuff, Cam?
Well, you know, we set up this big plot. They're going to build a giant time travel conduit, which...
The imagery of that, like when we get the to be continued shot with the space Nazi walking to that conduit.
Yeah.
Oh, that took my breath away, though. That was a phenomenal, like, directorial choice right there.
Yeah, I was sitting there through a lot of the first part, kind of a little bit annoyed by the lack of iconic images in that story. Like, you think about the, you know, the setting they're creating and everything, and it does feel a lot of it visually unimaginative.
Well, upstate New York looks suspiciously like Southern California.
With five people on the streets. And a lot of office hallways.
Well, I was thinking more specifically of like the forests, though.
Oh, okay.
Looking like Southern California versus the New York City backlot that they were obviously using. Whenever they use this backlot, does anyone actually think they went up to New York? Or does everyone just like know deep down like they're in the Paramount backlot? Like, I never feel as if I'm being transported into New York City itself.
Did you when you were young, though?
Never, no.
Really? You see, I was definitely fooled as a kid. Like, as a kid, I did think they shot where they said they were. And, you know, when I got a little older, you're like, oh, wait, no, they definitely aren't. But at the time, I was fooled more.
I remember growing up down in Seattle, and my dad was convinced that Frasier was, like, the sitcom was filmed in Seattle.
Right.
I was like, no, like, even as, like a kid, I knew that, no, that dad, Kelsey Grammer's not living, like, next door to us. It's, you know.
I thought Seinfeld was shot in New York when I watched it.
Yeah.
You know,
so
I just wasn't as bright, I guess.
No need to guess. Yeah. I just wasn't transported into this New York City backlot.
It's hard to be.
Yeah. So
I like that, transported into it.
Thank you. Well, what do you think about the idea of Alicia going up to the NX-01? You know, like...
I like it in theory.
I like it in theory, but you think about how well it was executed with, say, one Alfre Woodard or Lily Sloan in Star Trek First Contact.
Oh, that was definitely jumping to my mind, as well as in Who Watches the Watchers as well.
That's what I thought about as well.
Yeah.
And those were done far more effectively than having Alicia in a dead ensign's quarters looking at her Starfleet graduation photo.
Yeah.
It was like... Okay.
Yeah, there's also, I want to get back to that in a second. There's also the original series episode with the fighter pilot that winds up on the Enterprise. Like, I found that more moving. Like, the wonder in that character's eyes for this entire future ahead of them is really powerful. Here, I was like, who is Ensign O'Malley?
Well, but Alicia was also like, yeah, you know, just send me right back to New York.
Yeah.
And Archer's like, no, I can send you anywhere you want on Earth, you know, anywhere safer. Yeah, send me back to New York.
Like, what about the wonder of walking this character and letting them see the world beneath them? And she's like, yep, there it is.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow, boy, the magic of Star Trek was really gone. It was really absent in that moment.
It was a lost opportunity for sure.
Definitely, because that's a character, you know, Alicia's a character who I think... has a lot of potential. I don't know that she lands in the all-time great two-parter guest characters.
I honestly forgot all about her until I rewatched this episode.
I had to.
And the thing is, like, she was getting, the actress was getting special guest star credits as well. I was like,
yeah,
okay.
Golden Brooks was her name, yeah.
Yeah. I was looking it up, though. I think she was on, like, other UPN or CW shows, and, like, I think it was a cross-promotional thing, much like when The Rock was also on UPN's, like, wrestling series at the time that he went on Voyager. So
right,
I don't know. Speaking about, we did get Bobby Bacala from Sopranos as one of the zoot suit wearing gangsters. And did
hey, I'm an Italian stereotype on Star Trek.
I like how they also had to explain that they were gangsters, and I was like, guys, I think we figured it out. You know, by the 41 minute mark when you guys started talking about being loan sharks, I was just like, I think we had figured it out a while ago.
It was like, could they make it more obvious?
It is very, very... they literally hired an actor from The Sopranos to play one of them.
Yeah.
So I was just like, Okay, guys.
Yeah, I mean, putting aside all the horrors that organized crime has caused in humanity, I thought they were fun cartoonish characters.
Sure, sure.
But again, like, there is a weird kind of tone thing where we get a lot of the, you know, very like hateful, racist Nazi speech. But then we also get, like, buffoonish, cartoonish gangsters running around. It's a very odd mix of tones going on here.
Do you think it's, like, Manny Coto just saying, like, I want to look at, like, the entire Warner Brothers compendium of like, old movies and, like, just have fun mixing genres to a certain degree?
Maybe.
But did he do that? If that was the intent, how effectively was that done?
Not very well.
It's just kind of, like, I just think that this episode had so much against it going in.
Yeah.
That it's tough. And I will get to this as we wind up our conversation a little later on, but, like, did this need to be a two-parter? Like,
right.
There seemed as if there's a lot of filler going on in this one, and I wonder if they could have wrapped up the whole temporal Cold War thing in maybe 42 minutes versus nearly 90 minutes that we got here.
Yeah. What did you think of part one, though?
I think Star Trek keeps falling back into this, but I think part one was stronger than part two, because okay. I think there's a lot more world building, a lot more of like, here's some interesting characters, blah, 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 that you're being introduced to. Here are some potentially interesting situations. And then by the time you get to part two, it's let's race to fix all these, you know, plot mechanics that we've introduced before.
Right.
And it wasn't as much fun to watch. I think, look, there's a certain fun factor to just this concept of it. I liked a lot of the world building stuff, but I was definitely enjoying myself. And I also took a lot more notes during part one than I did in part two.
Same. Yeah.
There's just a lot less for me to comment on in part two because it just felt to be far more plot driven. Mm-hmm. One thing that I think they didn't really jump on that I think they could have in part one, though, is like this idea of like this ship lost in time.
Right.
There's no moments of the characters saying, like, what are we supposed to do now? Like, I don't understand. How did our entire ship get back here? How do we get back? Are we going to have to live in, like, this war-torn ancient planet now? And it's more like people saying, like, let's go find our captain. Let's go look for Captain Archer.
You do get Trip getting really annoyed off the bat, like, early in the episode, but then he's quickly like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just want to get home.
Exactly. And
yeah.
I think there's some potentially interesting things that we could have explored with, you know, T'Pol and Phlox, for example, being like aliens, saying like, what are we supposed to do here?
Yeah.
And what if they actually, I don't know, had like a 5-minute conversation about like, well, we can't interfere with this timeline. Should we zip off to another part of space and, I don't know, try to continue to explore? Like, I don't know, like there could have been some like fun kind of poking around about like possibilities for this crew, but it felt as if they knew like their jobs were already written in the script.
And, yeah.
You know,
well,
so
the problem is too, they have to get Archer. So their whole thing is, how do we get Archer? So they're not having those conversations because they'll have them when they find Archer.
Exactly.
And, you know, do you think that this whole like Nazi story might have worked better if it had been done, I don't know, later in season four, and you didn't have all the like all this temporal Cold War stuff? Like, could the idea of the Nazi, you know, time travel stuff worked better as even like a standalone story in season two?
I think potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. And if they really buckle down hard on that whole kind of like pure race sort of analogs between the Nazis and Vosk species, if they both believe those things. And I like the idea of introducing like this, you know, biological weapon that would have allowed the Nazis to realize their ultimate goal here. And I also like thinking about it just from like a practical perspective. Like, what if the world was just 100% Aryan?
Yeah.
I think the world, as we know, kind of ceases to function. And it's just like the villains never really think through their like master plan about like how things would work logistically or practically and how things would actually get quite messed up if this ever happened. So Nazis, not a fan of you, just putting it out there.
That's a controversial statement, Tyler.
I know. I'm brave for expressing that. Yeah. So. Getting into part two, though, I do kind of like the idea of Silic infiltrating the Enterprise. He keeps going on and off the ship, which is like hilarious, you know, but he is impersonating one Trip at this point. And I think that there could have been like more interesting things for the Suliban to have been doing this whole time. It had, you know, there have been more storylines about them infiltrating specific characters throughout an episode, you know,
yeah.
So
Look, you could have had a little more of that paranoia, like the episode where the changeling is on the Defiant.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, the Adversary.
Yeah.
Or even Homefront Paradise Lost, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. I think we were both kind of disappointed that they never really seized on that changeling paranoia throughout the course of Deep Space Nine, other than Martok insisting everybody cut their hands with the same knife,
mm-hmm.
which, like, not hygienic, if you ask me. So there you go. There. But, I do like... it was kind of a fun sort of beat where you have Phlox handing Archer the medical pad,
mm-hmm.
Archer looking at it, Phlox walking over to the intercon system, and then Archer slowly walking around the impersonator trip, and then they get into like a big wrestling match, you know? and then I love him running out, and then as soon as the Makos spot him, they just start firing their cannons at him. Just like, it was like, he's your commanding officer, but Phlox must have gotten a lot of information over to the security personnel.
Phlox is very efficient.
Very, very efficient, you know.
I really enjoyed the opening of the second part where you had that newsreel. Where you could see that, you know, this is feels like it fed a little bit into the opening of the Mirror Universe arc, which we're going to cover fairly soon. The idea of, you know, playing around with the opening of the show. And I thought this newsreel stuff, which mixed in footage from like Triumph of the Will and various news sources, it was really effective in creating the world of this two-parter.
For those that don't remember, what we get to see is Hitler on tour of New York City.
Yeah.
He's visiting Times Square. You see the Nazis goose stepping down Times Square. You see him at the Statue of Liberty. I think he's on the Empire State Building as well. So it's like, I did put a note down there too. I was just like, oh, this is for anybody that maybe missed the first part of this one. Mm-hmm. I think that this will actually grab your attention for a teaser. Like somebody's like sitting there saying like, oh, wait a minute, alt history.
Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. I wonder how this goes for the rest of the episode here. So I think that was actually a pretty brilliant teaser, regardless of what you think of the overall two-parter.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Zelig, the Woody Allen movie.
I've never seen that one.
Oh, where they put him into famous moments of history, but they kind of do the same thing here, and it's really effective here, and really, I thought, really a fun way to set up your part two. And but one thing I wanted to get to, you were referencing Archer tussling with Trip, and
I said wrestling.
Wrestling. Yeah. I feel like this is a very, very poor reintroduction of Archer to the Enterprise crew. This is a guy that they thought may have been dead at the end of Zero Hour, and this is his reintroduction onto the ship, and it just, there's like nothing to it. It just feels to me like drained of that sort of ceremony that you would hope for.
I disagree.
Really?
As soon as he gets back up to the bridge, everybody's cheering for him. Like, Hoshi runs up and gives him a big hug. You can tell that they're incredibly elated. When we have Trip and Mayweather see him on Earth for the first time, they're just blown away as well. Like I disagree with
you,
that.
You okay? Yeah, worked for you? Yeah. To me, it just did not feel like it had the emotion.
What moment? Like you were talking about, like Trip or Silic and Archer wrestling with each other, but that wasn't his reintroduction to the crew.
No, I'm saying before that, because you were talking about that. I'm saying before happens, all before all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it just, to me, I don't know. Like, I think of how epic the finale of Zero Hour was, and this just was like, okay, there we go. He's back. And it didn't feel like, to me, it really had the impact I wanted coming off of that story.
I think it was more of a slow build because, remember, they initially had him faintly trying to communicate with the ship, and that was their first clue that he was alive.
Right.
And so then they know he's alive, so it's about them being able to transport him back up to the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, as opposed to like one giant moment of elation, it's more like, oh, we're getting prepared. Our captain, he's still out there, even though we thought we had to leave him behind in that exploding Zindi weapon in you know, two episodes ago, or I guess an episode ago, because this is still towards the end of part one, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it worked for me, but I know what you're saying, and like, and I think is more of kind of a writing structure issue. So,
and also, I mean, I say all that, but I also can understand from the point of view of like Manny Coto, the situation he's been presented, where it's like, well, now he's in alternate World War II. You've got to get him out of this and back onto the ship. Like, I have sympathy.
I'm glad that they didn't keep him as, like, a POW or, like, somebody who's, like, stuck in New York City for this entire, like, two-parter. Like, that would have been kind of grating for me. So get him back on the ship. Make him more of an active player in what's going on here. And make Silic dress like Richie from Happy Days and send Silic back to Earth as one John Fleck as himself, which is... it just looked looked kind of weird hearing Siddick's voice coming out of like this regular looking human man dressed like something from American Graffiti.
Yeah, it was very strange to see Siddick in like normal human street clothes. And yeah, sans makeup. But what did you think of the use of Siddick here? Like, I found it disappointing. I like what they're doing. I like that they're taking this character and doing new things, you know, obviously taking the makeup off the character and letting him blend in. Like, it's all what I want to see with my Star Trek adversaries, presenting them in a new light, but it just feels dramatically kind of flat and far more simple than I would have ever hoped for that character.
Well, there are moments like Siddick saying, like, well, based on my interactions with you NX-01 people, I would have thought your species was always very passive, mm-hmm. and then they don't really go anywhere with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of like one of those points that's brought up, but they didn't really dig into it. And I think that's what Star Trek does well, is like kind of dig into those points rather than just like floating ideas and doing nothing with them.
Yeah. And it doesn't feel like he gets like juicy dialogue, really. Yeah. It doesn't feel like when you see some of the other series and they're writing out an antagonist where you really do, you know, like you look at some what felt like multiple farewells for Gul Dukat. He usually had pretty great lines.
Sure. Yeah. This was no Gul Dukat. Like, if you're thinking about the primary antagonist of each series,
yeah.
Of course, you've got the Borg Queen for Voyager. You've got Gul Dukat for Deep Space Nine. And then you've got Siddick for Star Trek Enterprise.
Yes.
I don't think he quite compares.
My favorite moment.
And you've got Q for TNG, too.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah.
It's like, think about those four. I think Siddick's kind of bottom rung.
His farewell is probably a little more satisfying than Sela, but
sure. Just a little.
Yeah, but it's not that far off. But I did like the moment where the gangster character says, like, give this man a prize. And he's like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
I thought that was fun. I'm like, that's the most memorable thing I got out of him.
But it's just very telling that they're like, okay, well, let's just kill him off. Like I think killing off Siddick with a couple gunshots to the back, it's their way of saying, we are done with this temporal Cold War.
Yeah.
Don't expect it to come up again. And I'm fine with that, even though we never got to find out the identity of Future Guy, which I don't care, because whatever answer you get, it's going to be unsatisfying.
Yeah.
Or it's going to make you scratch your head and be like, hey, that makes no sense. So leave it ambiguous. I'm a fan of ambiguity, though. Like, I don't think we need every single thing explained. And I think leaving it up to interpretation is a far more fruitful thing as viewers to do than getting all the answers like beaten into our heads like every single time we watch something.
Sure. Although I would say in this case, there's nothing for you to really use as evidence to inform your ambiguity. Like, it's hard to interpret anything from it.
But any answer that they would have given you,
yes.
you would not have been satisfied and you would have been frustrated. So that's why...
Unless they had something in mind off the bat that they built.
They didn't, yeah. though. And so that's why I'm like, just leave it blank and I'm far happier.
Well, yeah, you can just assume it's someone in the 29th century.
Sure.
You know, some species or something we don't know about.
Don't care.
Don't worry. We'll get to them further down the road, guys, in a whole other Star Trek series.
Probably, yeah.
But yeah, like, I thought...
It's the Dax symbiont the entire time.
Future guy. No, it's Tuvix.
Yeah, he's back and he's ready for vengeance.
That's right. But I thought...
He always said that you guys will never forget what you've done to me.
I thought Siddick's death was really lame.
Yeah, just like, get shot in the back and
like so
then he croaks.
They give him kind of like this weird hero moment where he doesn't have a gun and then he runs out and takes down like two soldiers and then immediately gets shot in the back and you're like, well, I get that they were trying to have this character go out like in a blaze of glory, but...
I think they ran out of the budget by the end of the episode, though.
It was like a single match strike of glory.
Yeah.
It was very weak.
Yeah. So they also just kind of left the alien body like dead.
Yeah, I thought about that too.
I mean, of course, you know, the timeline was like wiped clean, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like, okay, I wonder what everyone else thinks when they find this alien body just laying there. So
yeah, we do get a visual in around this part that's probably my favorite thing in the episode, which is the NX-01 like flying over the city.
Cam, that's okay. So is that when it's like just kind of dawn is breaking, and like that to me was the most striking visual.
Yeah.
Or like I was really blown away by kind of just like that sort of amber hue that was hitting the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had like the battle damage on it from the Zindi arc, which I'm just like, that's the thing that bums me out about Voyager. It's just like the ship always looked pristine.
Right.
And you just saw how like rattled the NX-01 was after their Zindi mission. I'm just like, Voyager, you should have been doing this. Like, I know like budgetary wise, like in those early seasons with your model, it would have been hard, but you had like CG ships from like season four on. Like you right. could have made this happen.
Well, I mean, the thing is, though, Voyager probably had about 1,000 little repair bots like Discovery did that went out and fixed it.
Yeah, exactly. That was, yeah.
The NX-01 didn't have those.
We'll see if they still have them in the 31st century.
Right.
We'll find out soon enough.
But I did like, yeah, this shot of like the NX-01, even like the like aerial dogfight over the city. Like just, those were beautiful shots.
Yeah, I was totally into that.
I would have loved a little more of that. I mean, that to me was probably the lone real iconic imagery from the episode. I would say the other image you would probably point out is the shot of the first shot of the Nazi alien, but that comes in Zero Hour, so much this one.
And I'd also point to the Nazi-occupied White House. You know, like that stood out to me for sure.
For sure.
Okay, so look, the timeline is reset. Silic's dead. I'll give props to this. The moment where the ship arrives home and it's greeted by an armada of, you know, Vulcan ships, Earth ships, it's the welcome that Voyager never got, really.
Right.
You know, I really did appreciate that moment. I really wanted to, like, jump forward and watch the next episode home, where it's like, it's after, like, 25 episodes of the crew just being absolutely tortured, they just finally get some relief. They just finally get to just kind of cool their jets. Trip can hit Cancun. He hasn't decided yet between that. And what was the other one? I think he wanted to go to like the Bahamas or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. He wanted to go to a different beach every week or like that for 2 months.
So it just made me appreciate like, okay, mission completed. You've saved the Earth. You've saved the timeline. You guys can just relax for a little while. Like props to you. Like I thought it was a well-deserved like kind of conclusion. This was both the conclusion to the Temporal Cold War is really the conclusion to the Zindi arc as well, essentially.
Yeah, no, I agree. I really enjoyed that, arriving back on Earth. I thought that was a great moment. But you skimmed over, I think, arguably the most powerful moment of the whole episode, if not the entirety of Enterprise, which is when they're resetting the timeline. And we get Daniels there, you know, Archer, isn't this beautiful? See all the famous sites of history. And we're seeing, you know, just all these iconic moments, the pyramids, dinosaurs. And we see Archer outrunning fire.
I saw that. I did notice that.
And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It was something to behold.
Yeah, it truly
it
was.
It still is. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I think that moment actually landed in our most iconic moments episode as well for
it did.
Star Trek there. So.
And Daniels agrees.
Yeah, I can't blame him.
History agrees.
Yeah.
And what do you think of like Archer's farewell with Daniels here? He's just like, leave me alone.
Good. Like, I'm good. Archer got it out of there. It just seems like well, maybe let's talk about like the Temporal Cold War overall. I think it is a fundamentally flawed sort of overarching premise for a series in that all of it just seems to be so out of the control of our less technologically advanced crew.
It's not even in their timeline.
Exactly. And so it's like all they can be are kind of the passive agents and everything just happens to them.
And they need a Daniels there to like direct them the whole time.
Which from a storytelling perspective isn't fun for viewers to watch at all. It's just like watching things happen to your crew and then they react and it's just like, okay, you know, like it's hard for us to be really invested as opposed to our characters being the directors of their own destiny to a certain degree. It seemed as if destiny was happening to them.
Well, when you look at the Dominion War, where the Dominion are up to their own things, but once the war starts, Sisko's taking, you know, an active role in leading the strategic battles and everything. He's playing a role in the ongoing conflict. Whereas, like, what is Archer doing in all this? It's a lot of him getting dropped into these, you know, often CG green screen environments with Daniels explaining everything to him and him getting annoyed. And you don't get the sense of him getting to, as you say, an active role, but it's not a compelling role either. It's like we never get to see Archer in a, guys, we are a ship that has to do something that no human has ever done. We have to stop a temporal cold war. It's more like Daniels just pops in and bothers Archer, and then Archer has to go to his crew and be like, I don't know.
But that's what happens when you have a network-mandated storyline that the creative team is not really invested in. So it's the creative team trying to insert things that it just never really worked for me, and I don't think that it worked for the writers either, and I think this is kind of just the acknowledgement that it never really worked here.
Yeah, and as a finale to it, Stormfront is actually, it plays more straight than I remembered it. Like, it doesn't feel as convoluted as one might think as a finale to the temporal Cold War.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also that much more frustrating because of that. It just feels incredibly simplistic to the point where you're like, wait, why were we jumping through all these hoops for two straight seasons for something this straightforward?
I just don't know if Manny Coto could have done much more.
That's the thing. I don't think you could have.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's tackle this. Does Stormfront justify itself as a two-part episode?
I would say in terms of like the Nazi plot of the story, no. But I also don't know that you would wrap up the temporal Cold War in a single episode. So it's like this weird thing where I think the overall story of it is pretty simple and could have been done in one episode, but I don't know that you could include all this nonsense with the temporal Cold War and still, like, if you packed all that stuff into a single episode, it might have been a mess.
I still think that because of how simple it was to wrap up the temporal Cold War, you could have easily done this in one episode.
Yeah.
I don't think this justifies itself as a two-part episode, really. Like, I think it there seemed as if there could have been a lot of fat to be trimmed. There are a lot of wardroom scenes between the Nazis and Vosk. There's a lot of, you know, wisecracking gangsters that weren't actually all that amusing.
Right.
You know, like, there's just, I think they could have just stuck to a very simple plot and, you know, resolve this weird cliffhanger that Brandon Braga left them with and resolve the temporal Cold War. Because the thing is, I don't think viewers really cared. I don't think the writers really cared. I don't think the actors knew what was going on any given moment. So it's just like, who's really invested in this other than some like network head that was probably fired like 6 months after Enterprise premiered? Like,
probably.
So,
but yeah, like, I find Stormfront to be incredibly unsatisfying as a conclusion to the temporal Cold War. But I also find it incredibly unsatisfying as a basically the final, I guess, button on the Zindi War. Because unfortunately, it kind of wedges itself in there as your final beat of the Zindi War.
That last moment, the last shot, though, with them approaching the fleet of ships, I thought it was great.
But imagine if that was at the end of 0 Hour.
That moment would have been even greater.
Yeah.
But it still, to me, was a great moment. So I can't complain too much about this.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Overall, this episode, it actually played better on rewatch than I thought it was going to. It's a perfectly watchable thing. There's enough, like, wackiness, enough world building that it wasn't torture to sit through this. But overall, I don't think this is going to go down as one of Enterprise's strongest.
Yeah, I mean, it has so many problems just that fundamentally as a two-parter and all the, basically, the masters it has to serve and what it wants to accomplish. And I don't think any of them, it's as you said, I just don't think the writers, they were not firing on all cylinders with this one. I'm sure it was a lot of just problem solving. How do we get all this finished in two episodes so that we can then do our, you know, augments arc, our Vulcan arc, all the stuff we're actually interested in. So it's
that was done to good effect. You can tell that
effect,
they're very, very energized by the stories that were to come. They just had to get this out of the way.
Energized.
Yes.
But yeah, like, it just feels like, you know, no one's super invested. And so I feel like that's really evident as watching it. Yeah, it wasn't as convoluted as much as a mess as my memory of it was, which, hey, that's a point in its favor. But at the same time, I found it kind of just dull and plodding to sit through, waiting for like the inevitable return home at the end, when I knew that, boy, at this point onwards, we get to cover some two-parters that are fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, disappointing.
Yeah, really looking forward to the Klingon disease arc.
That wasn't the one I had in mind,
okay.
But yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, it is yet another short track. This is that Pike-focused one, so we'll be doing a review on that. It'll be a fun one. We really love doing these short tracks. They're just like these fun adventures. They genre hop all the time. I think they're really doing what Star Trek has always done best. So I'm very, very much looking forward to having a Pike back on the small screen yet again for us to ogle him and Anson Mount and all that. So it's like, yeah.
For sure. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vosk, you ain't no Tosk, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's Reporton, N as in Nazi conduit.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
But it's funny now and then, how my thoughts go flashing back again to my old flame. mouth flame.
Transfer complete.